Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're opening today with exciting news for farmers, gardeners, and everyone who loves our land resources. The Northeast Organic Farming Association of Connecticut, NOFA CT, is with us and previewing the upcoming 41st Winter Conference that's going to be held the second week of March virtually, but concluding on March 11th with the first in-person gathering and celebration in several years, and it's happening at Wesleyan University. Then we're going to tell you about CONI, the Connecticut Health Information Exchange, that's required to be implemented by May. Apparently, there are serious privacy concerns about it and a lot that consumers aren't aware of. So we're going to welcome back the president of the Connecticut Psychological Association to clue everyone in about CONI and some concerns. Then we're going to close with more good environmental news. Have you heard? A 41-mile stretch of the Housatonic River in northwestern Connecticut has received a federal designation of wild and scenic, which should lead to better protections for the waterway. So we're going to be bringing in a leader from the Housatonic Valley Association, one of the two organizations that helped Connecticut earn this high-profile national designation, to hear all about it. We're going to be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder about another group that we love so much. We want you to join Special Olympics Connecticut for their 2023 annual awards dinner at the AquaTurf Club in Southington on Monday, March 13th, honoring outstanding athletes, volunteers, and sponsors who exemplify the spirit of Special Olympics and have made a significant impact on the organization. Athlete and global messenger Robin Batchelder is going to be the keynote speaker, and single tickets are available, or you can just get your organization or workplace together and grab a table of 10, because proceeds are benefiting the athletes of Special Olympics Connecticut. However, those tickets need to be purchased in advance by Friday, March 3rd, so get your table or your plans together and visit SOCT.org for details. Well, we were just saying off mic how thrilled I am just being able to put on my calendar that I'm going back to a NOFA conference, and it is coming, and it is not going to be on my Zoom screen, at least not all of it. I'm so thrilled that Connecticut NOFA is presenting their 41st Winter Conference, and it's going to be held the second week of March, kicking off on the 6th with virtual workshops, but concluding at last on March 11th with an in-person gathering and celebration at Wesleyan University. We're here with Jeremy Pelletier. He is the president of NOFA Connecticut, the Northeast Organic Farming Association. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, just beyond that brief introduction, remind people a little bit about NOFA and why Connecticut's segment of this organization is so important to get to know, whether you want a healthy yard or you want healthy commercial landscaping or a great garden or the closest walk to the healthiest, cheapest, most fantastic food you ever want to eat.
Yeah, thanks. So yeah, CT NOFA has been around since 1982. We're the only organization in Connecticut dedicated to organic agriculture and organic land care. We'd love for folks listening to get involved in some way, whether it's becoming a member or joining us at the conference, but we advocate for organics in Connecticut. Whether you're a farm, whether you're a gardener, an activist, we try to be the voice of for you at the state and national level. We have a ton of great programs going on, one of which started last year called the Farm Share Program, where we work with farms to discount CSAs, so folks. So there's better access to CSAs. CSAs can be a little cost prohibitive. And so we're working with farms right now to basically cut in half the price of CSAs for folks who might not normally be able to afford them. And then the farm gets paid in full as well. But, you know, you can check out our website, c2nofa.org, where you can find organic landscapers that are trained through NOFA, organic farms and organic farm stands. And we have a ton of benefits as well to being members.
Cool. It's also a time for professionals who may not know about NOFA certifications to maybe get hip to that, because it is a spectacular niche to market themselves with, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And we have a couple of ways where we can help with that. If you're a landscaper or a landscape designer, we have training on organic land care, and we accredit you in organic land care. The interesting thing with landscaping is it's not regulated. The word organic is not regulated like it is in agriculture. So NOFA, back in the late 90s, defined what that meant in the terms of landscaping. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, we offer credential in organic land care. So when people are hiring their land care professionals, now it's, you know, now is the time to hire your professionals for your yard. You can trust that if they're accredited through NOFA, they're following a set of practices that are accepted internationally under IFOAM. And there's a baseline of what you can expect, much like with agriculture.
So to bridge the initiative of individuals in those professions who might want to seek that certification and our continued promotion of the upcoming 41st Winter Conference, will there be at least one segment on the virtual or in-person agenda that is addressing or beckoning these professionals to learn more?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, we have a whole set of workshops on organic land care. So there's something for everyone here. If you go to c2nofa.org, you can find all of the different workshops we're offering. But yeah, we do have a specific set of workshops for landscapers. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So looking across the landscape of the virtual workshops, what might be a one or two that individuals could consider attending if, you know, they've experimented, they've done maybe a window box garden or a little carve out in their yard or on their property and grew some tomatoes and kale or whatever over the past few years, or some beans or what have you. But they are ready to, as I kind of said earlier, get more of a produce aisle right in their own backyard. What are a couple of the workshops, virtual or in person, that they might want to make sure they're penciling into their schedule to attend?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you are a beginning gardener or if you're an advanced gardener, there's a few workshops that I think might interest folks. We have a workshop on beekeeping in the urban environment, so keeping bees if you're in, you know, in a city rather than in a rural area. Mm-hmm. We have organic disease management. So if you're having trouble with some pests and disease in your yard, in your garden, we got best edible perennials for foodscaping. So if you're really into an edible garden, that's a great workshop led by Dave Scandura. He's up in Cape Cod. Mm-hmm. We have a workshop called Food as Medicine, which is a great workshop to attend if you're a beginning gardener or an advanced farmer. And that's just the virtual side. So we have, you know, getting started in pasture raising, with pasture raised livestock. If you're a little bit more advanced, we have a workshop on microgreens 101, zooming in on composting on your farm and on your property. We have, organic turf care for the turf folks or folks who want an organic lawn. There's just a ton of workshops that I think will cater to a large audience, if you're a beginning farmer, or beginning gardener, up to advanced.
Excellent. Switching from gardening to farming, which is something that is so important to us here in Connecticut, while we don't have the huge hundreds of acres of tracts of land that folks may have in more western and southern provinces, what we lack in the smaller quantity, we certainly make up for in quality. We've got a ton of really unique small gardeners and specialty agriculture industry here, and I see one of the workshops is addressing something that is starting to be a real thing, and that's owning and working with and producing some sort of revenue and benefits with the sweet alpacas.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Judy Apicella is coming in.
Yes, yeah. She's taught at our conference a couple of times, and she has a great workshop about homesteading with alpacas and herbs. It's always a great time with Bella Alpacas. They've been here as a vendor before, and they've certainly taught a couple of workshops. So that's a great one to attend as well.
One of the other things that is sometimes daunting to folks, even when they want to start their own little patio or backyard garden, is the prospect of having to invest in the necessary tools. And you guys have kind of addressed that bill with Shirlene Rodriguez, who's coming in to talk about sharing farm tools.
Yeah, absolutely. It's called a tool library. It's not a new concept, but it certainly doesn't exist at a large scale in Connecticut. And she has, she created sort of this outline of how one would work. So if that's definitely something that I would hope a lot of people attend, because it's something that's needed in Connecticut for sure.
And in the interest of making the NOFA conference as rich and diverse as possible, I have to say, Jeremy, we've talked to a number of community garden folks who have really been bursting with excitement over the multicultural presence of neighbors in a lot of these community gardens, and how they're educating entire neighborhoods and entire communities about the great food that their culture brings. And I see you're addressing that with a workshop on growing ethnic crops.
Yeah, it's going to be a great workshop. It's the first one we've done, I think, like this, and so at least since I've been here. But getting to the root, growing ethnic crops, which is going to be led by UConn Extension, and it'll feature a panel discussions. It'll feature farmer Juliet Manhenga, and it'll be a really great workshop to attend if you're interested in that.
So now, switching gears to the in-person conference, I'm sure there's great excitement around your keynote speaker. Let's hear a little about that.
Absolutely, yeah. So this conference, it's interesting. We're actually expanding on what we normally do. In 2020, normally we have a one-day conference live, and that was last held in 2020. We then switched over to a virtual conference in 2021 and 2022. And this year we're doing both. We're having a week of virtual workshops and a virtual conference, and then a full day conference live in person at Wesleyan University. We're really, really excited to have Leah Penniman as our keynote speaker. She has a new book coming out, Black Earth Wisdom, that she'll be talking about, and some of the themes that are discussed in that book. She's also the author of Farming While Black, and we're so excited to have her again as our keynote speaker.
And just taking a quick zoom in on a couple of the workshops, I guess I shouldn't even use the Z word because it's the in-person portion of the conference.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting ones that I'm seeing here kind of dovetails really well with the way Connecticut has been working to support the hemp industry. With all the talk about legal recreational cannabis, it mm-hmm. seems like the poor hemp aspect of those plants has really kind of taken a back seat. And you're coming back in a big way, helping people understand industrial hemp.
Yeah, it'll be led by that that workshop, Industrial Hemp, will be led by Hector Dorado, who is on our board. He's from Samaran Farmstead, and he's going to talk about regenerative farming with hemp and using it as a cash crop. But also, we have a workshop right after that on outdoor cannabis cultivation by Lupino of Gene Traders, and it'll cover different methods used to cultivate cannabis outdoors in different parts of the country, and I'll highlight some of the environmental impacts and benefits of cultivating the cannabis plant outside. So there's a good representation of what's to come in Connecticut at this conference.
And another important thing is to keep the land and the water that feeds all of this organic product healthy. And with that in mind, and in the last couple of minutes that we have with you, as we're wrapping up kind of our switch and focus to the in-person conference at Wesleyan, the day-long event with all these great workshops, you're bringing in Jay Archer to talk about taking care of the necessary natural raw materials that will keep organic gardening and all gardening sustainable for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jay Archer is actually an accredited organic landscaper through NOFA, and he's had decades of experience. He's coming down from upstate New York to teach this workshop, and he is very knowledgeable. And anyone who's interested in ecological restoration, landscaping, or farming, this is definitely a workshop to attend.
The other thing that so many people in the agricultural industry and in NOFA care about is hunger. And it's so great to see that Reggie St. Fort Collins coming in with this community fridge workshop to sort of wrap up the day of live in-person workshops at Wesleyan University on March 11th. Tell us a little bit about this, how to create a community fridge section.
Yeah, so Reggie's fantastic. He's a community organizer. He's created and developed community fridges throughout Connecticut, in Bridgeport. I believe he has an online presence. It's called Fridgeport, that you can check out. But he really empowers folks to create community fridges around their neighborhoods, and he is very knowledgeable about doing that. So. This is a great addition to this year's conference.
Great. Really, I mean, when you think of the cliche, something for everyone, you can toss that out, because the 41st NOFA Connecticut Winter Conference really, truly does have something for everyone, happening virtually starting on Monday, March 6th, but culminating in the first live conference in a few years at Wesleyan University on March 11th. We hope folks will register and get involved, or at least go to ctnofa.org, click under the Winter Conference, and take a look at this incredible variety of workshops that you can partake in. And if for some reason you don't see anything of interest on the conference, at least consider being a part of Connecticut NOFA and supporting the organization through membership or a donation. Their president has been kind enough to preview the conference, and we will be at the conference as far as we could tell right now, building a full 1 hour program around it. So Jeremy, we look forward to seeing you there. Jeremy Pelletier is president of NOFA CT. Thank you so much for your time today to preview the show.
Thank you. Thank you. And I just want to mention too, that this year we have a sliding scale. So there's a price point for everyone, And thanks to our sponsors, we have a lot of fee waivers available. So costs, we don't want costs to be a barrier to attend this conference.
Great. And folks can inquire about that through the website application as well.
Exactly.
CTNOFA.org is the place to go. Jeremy, we'll see you at Wesleyan. Thank you so much. We're so pleased to have a familiar voice with us on the line for this midpoint segment, and it's an important one. Jennifer Doran's with us. She is a independent practitioner and president of the Connecticut Psychological Association, our go-to resource for things folks need to know. The association is the voice of psychology and psychologists in Connecticut. They advocate for professional psychology advances, psychology as a science, and promoting human welfare. And we're certainly going to do a lot of that latter thing in our conversation this morning. And we've got a lot to talk about. So Jennifer, I'll say welcome once again. Thank you for bringing this issue to our attention. And we will jump into talking about Connecticut's Health Information Exchange, CONEY, and some important things that individuals and practitioners need to know. But real quick, beyond the individual points that we'll make, what else do folks need to know about CPA?
Just that CPA is here as a resource for all things mental health, and we are happy to help them be a resource however we can. It's a pleasure to be here, as always, John.
Great. So, tell me about CONEY. Introduce me to CONEY.
Yes, I would love to. So CONEY is the Connecticut Statewide Health Information Exchange. It was an initiative that was passed into law in 2017 and is just now sort of being implemented in the state, kind of started last year through Connecticut's Office of Health Strategy. It is intended to be a safe and confidential way of providers to share healthcare information with each other. So it is an integrated health information exchange, a place where regardless of what type of professional you are, what type of healthcare professional you are, or where you practice, whether that is a hospital or an institution or a practice, or you're completely independent, that you are connected to this system and able to, you know, obtain other healthcare information about people that you are working with.
So what was the impetus? I mean, obviously, amalgamating health records to a central off-site based and easily accessible location, it kind of speaks for itself. It's really important if you're riding a bike in Arizona, but you're from Hartford and you fall and you become unconscious and they want to be able to treat you and make sure that you don't have any pre-existing health conditions, then somewhere in the world, somebody's going to be able to access this information, even though it may not be where you live, right?
Yeah, and the CONEY system is Connecticut-based, so it will be used in Connecticut. And the ultimate goal, as you're talking about, is to be able to connect and be viewable across the country, you know, to other states who have a health information exchange and national systems as well. So yes, that in the event of an emergency, especially if you're not able to provide healthcare information about yourself, a provider would be able to access that.
And at this point, there are many, if not most, providers throughout the state already connected and beginning the transition to the system.
Yeah, so I think most providers who are affiliated with a hospital or a large institution will be connected already and will have begun the process of sharing data already. Very small practices and independent practitioners are likely not connected yet and not sharing data yet. However, there is a statewide mandate, so a legal mandate, that every licensed practitioner in our state begin the process of connecting to the system and using the system by May 3rd of this year.
So One of the concerns I know that you and the association and your members have is the lack of what you're calling an exception or carve out for mental health data. What do we need to know about that?
Yeah, and I want to say first how important it is that mental health be included as a discipline and as a profession. There is no health without mental health. Mental and physical health are one and the same and very connected, as we know. So it is important that mental health is a part of a statewide health information exchange. However, mental health data and information is also sensitive. It's different than something like a blood type, right? Or, just listing, a medical condition. Mental health conditions can be stigmatizing. There are often cases where people prefer that they are private or not disclosed. There are things like substance use to consider. Mental health data is different, and we feel that there hasn't been enough differentiation or discussion around how that information is going to be treated differently and viewable differently. So there is sort of a general lack of guidance about how much and what mental health professionals are going to be expected to share, and frankly should be sharing, given the sensitive nature of the work. Mm. So while we very much support the spirit of what is occurring, there are also some very real concerns about what that means for mental health and the consumers of mental health services.
The other thing that I guess should be clarified is that while the CONI system is kind of uniform and, like a one-stop shop, the mandate only indicates that practitioners need to begin connecting by May of 2023, which I guess is broad, subject to broad interpretation as to the difference between beginning connecting and actually fully utilizing the system, right?
Yeah, and this is one of the things that most providers are really confused about. And, to be fair, there has not been good communication about what is required or not and what that actually means. So step one, and this is the part that is legally mandated by May 3rd, is that they have to sign up. They have to sign up to the system, connect, share some basic information, phone number, email address, et cetera, things like that. However, once providers do that, they are then being asked, and this part is not required at this point, so this is not part of the legal mandate, but providers are being asked to sign kind of a very lengthy, complicated legal document. I believe it's 69 pages in length, and are then encouraged to begin sharing data, which again is a wonderful thing in spirit, but there are concerns about the legal document that haven't been addressed yet. There's actually an entire legal team kind of working on that and, articulating what those specific concerns are so that they can be worked through and clarified before people are signing the document and before people are sharing data. And again, there needs to be much clearer guidelines around how we're going to be using this for mental health and what should be shared, shouldn't be shared, needs to stay protected before providers just begin inputting information about their patients.
And as we lead into a break and then turn our attention to things that clients and individual consumers and patients need to know, the bridge between those patients and clients and the healthcare providers are bound together by something called affirmative consent.
Yeah, and that's such an important piece. This is a cornerstone of what we do in healthcare, and especially mental health care. We should not be sharing information about people without their concern, right? There are big privacy debates in our country happening as we speak, right? Whether we're talking about healthcare or social media or any number of things. People need to be comfortable with the data that is being shared about them, and people need to be aware that CONI exists and that providers, have the option to share data about them. It's a big issue from a consumer rights perspective and from a privacy perspective, and one, again, that has not been, kind of adequately addressed as the system is already kind of up and running and rolling.
While there are myriad point to the conversation we are concentrating exclusively today with Jennifer Doran, who is the president of the Connecticut Psychological Association, on the imminent rollout of CONNIE, which is the Connecticut Health Information Exchange. We're going to come back after the break and speak almost exclusively to points for you as consumers and patients of the medical entities that are going to be bound to at least begin connecting to CONNIE in just a couple of months. Jennifer, stay with us, folks. I hope you'll come back and listen. We've got lots more to talk about. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. February is National Senior Independence Month, and a perfect time to remind Connecticut families about an important state program that pays friends and family members to care for their qualified aging loved ones, 65 or over, in their own homes. If you'd like to learn more about the Connecticut Adult Family Living and Foster Caregiver Program, it's part of the Department of Social Services Connecticut Home Care Program for Elders. All you need to do is go to the state website, portal.ct.gov/DSS, and search for the Adult Family Living Program. We're back with Jennifer Doran, president of the Connecticut Psychological Association, advocating for professional psychology, advancing psychology as a science, and promoting human welfare. We're talking about CONNIE, a single subject of our conversation here at the midpoint of the program this morning. And as we heard just before handing off to the break, something that providers are going to need to do is sign off on something called affirmative consent to ensure that patients are fully aware of the accessibility to data about their health conditions. So now, Jennifer, let's turn to the most important points that consumers and patients need to know, which I guess, sadly, is they need to know, right?
Yeah. Patients have rights, right? Consumers of all healthcare services have rights, and there is an expectation, especially in mental health, as there should be, to privacy. One of the things that, you know, we feel is most problematic about the rollout that is occurring is the fact that, you know, anybody that I know in my network, whether that's a provider, a professional, you know, friends, family members, colleagues, no one that I know has been told about this in any medical or mental health appointment that they've had over the past year or two. That's concerning. That is a problem, right? If there's sort of open access among different healthcare institutions and providers to my personal medical and mental health information, I certainly want to know that, right? I want to know who can see my data and what they can see, what is a part of that record. Patient data is being shared, and to the best of my knowledge, consumers are not being informed that this is occurring.
A few of the other things that are concerning to me just from the sidelines is the fact that a lot of times when people who are juggling challenges, whether it's their own or a loved one's mental health challenge, or especially some sort of invasive physical health problem, that they don't have a lot of time or bandwidth to be able to really, fully be able to understand complicated things like this new generation electronic medical record sharing system. So they may hear that they have an opt-out situation that they could take advantage of. However, they need to be reminded that if they opt out, they opt out all the way, right?
Yeah. And again, you know, I think in an ideal world, the system would be more nuanced, and hopefully it will be, right? It's new. We're imagining it's going to change and adapt over time. You do have the ability to opt out of the CONI system, but it's all or nothing. So you're either participating and your data is there, or it's not at all. So if you are comfortable with your, you know, blood type and physical data, medical data being shared, but not your mental health, you don't have the ability to make that distinction.
Check the box,
it's
right.
either all included or not included at this time. It's also important that consumers are aware that even if you opt out of this system, which means that your data is not sort of immediately searchable by, you know, one provider or institution or the other, even if you opt out, providers can and likely will be using the secure emailing feature that is a part of this system to communicate with each other. Again, informed consent, they should be letting you know if they're going to do that. That's important. But providers can still, you know, email and share data that way through the CONI system. But your information will either be searchable to providers or hospitals, you know, if you go to the emergency room, God forbid, or not. So not a lot of nuance.
And one of the other things people need to take into consideration when they're weighing whether to stay on or opt out is that national HIEs and health insurance companies will have access to data on you if they're connected to the system and you're opting in, right?
Yeah. And again, there's not a lot of information yet about what is going to be accessible to who, right? When, where, why, you know, for what purpose. So there's many, many unknowns. And again, we're just, you know, concerned without more guidance, without more clarity about kind of moving forward full speed ahead, especially for mental health data.
Well, for parents and legal guardians of young people, I mean, we certainly heard an explosion of talk around the country about parental rights and what they feel they have a right to know about minor children. In fact, once an individual aged 12 to 17 is on CONI, those individuals and their records are protected even from their own parents.
Yeah, beginning at the age of 12. So parents would not have access to any information available on CONI for minors, you know, between the ages of 12 and 17. That is not true for earlier children, but again, we're not sure what they will have access to, how to access it, how much information. So more questions than answers.
And one of the other areas that is certainly having money thrown at it, rightfully so, especially with the advent of the fentanyl era, is that substance use disorder data will not be routinely collected, even though that's going to be representing a exponentially growing piece of healthcare in the coming years.
Yeah, and it, like everything we're talking about today, it's complicated because they're not, you know, asking people, like they're not routinely collecting substance use data, like saying put in if your patient has a substance use problem. However, that does not mean that no substance information is going to make its way into the record. If you are experiencing an overdose and you go to the emergency room, right, there may be notes accessible through CONI, or there may be a record that indicates that you were there for an overdose and what you overdosed on. And then that's a part of your searchable record. So not asking for it and not collecting it is different than what may be in there, you know, at a given institution or healthcare setting.
Well, so a lot to think about. I hope folks access the podcast if they think they've missed something and re-listen. But in the meantime, in the last minute or so that we have with you, Jennifer, what are a couple of the best things that consumers and patients can do to learn more?
I think the most important thing that we as consumers of healthcare services need to do is talk to our healthcare providers about CONI and about how they're using that, whether that's a hospital, whether that's your primary care physician, whether that's your psychologist, your mental health professional. You are entitled to know, you have a right to know if your provider is connected, if they're sharing data, what they're sharing about you, and who can access your information. The Connie website has a customer support number that you can call. You can actually say who has accessed my information, right? You can get a list of who is looking at your healthcare data. Again, your healthcare provider should be telling you before that's happening, but there are ways to kind of find out who's in your record as well. That phone number for anyone who's interested is 866-987-5514. The Connie website, which is ConnieCT.org, also has a lot of information. That's also where you'll find the opt-out form if that's something that you'd like to pursue at this time.
And Connie is C-O-N-N-I-E. It is the new statewide health information exchange due to be implemented with full participation of all Connecticut providers in some way, shape, or form in May. We appreciate you, Jennifer Duran, for coming in on behalf of the Connecticut Psychological Association to help us all be more aware of it and what we need to know about it, so at least consumers and patients can help make decisions with the consultation, hopefully, of their medical providers. I'm sure we'll be talking more about this, Jennifer, but for now, thank you so much for your time. Well, we're pleased to be back with Lynn Werner, who's representing the Housatonic Valley Association, and we have got big news. Just recently, this organization was designated, the work that this organization has done in partnership with the Housatonic River Commission has earned them a designation of wild and scenic. That's something that folks used to call me at closing time, Lynn, but here we are with it being much, much more important and impactive, because if I understand, it really sort of puts this section of the Housatonic River here in Connecticut into a national, if not global, spotlight. Welcome to the program, and we're so pleased to be able to circle back with you to talk about this.
Well, thanks, John. I'm thrilled to be here and thrilled to be able to discuss this effort that's been underway for more than four decades.
Right. Long time coming. And, 41 miles, it's almost like a mile per year since the effort started, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, the whole thing started when Wild and Scenic, the federal Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, was kind of in its infancy. And it had originally been established, I think, contemplating the larger rivers out west, where there's a lot of, public land alongside those rivers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the smaller rivers of New England, where you've got dense populations right up alongside the rivers, most of the land is privately held. I'm not sure that the National Park Service or really anybody well-intentioned and getting this act passed had really contemplated what it might mean and how it might play out on these small rivers. So the effort started, but there was a lot of, lack of detail about how it would be implemented on rivers in places like New England. And so it kind of petered out. We got a study done back in the late 70s that clearly showed this stretch of river qualified for wild and scenic status, and this stretch starts at the Massachusetts border and it goes down to northern New Milford at a place called Boardman Bridge, about 41 miles, as you said. But the designation was never pursued locally. There was a lot of confusion about what it might mean. And over the years, my organization, the Housatonic Valley Association, and the River Commission, the Housatonic River Commission, which actually was formed as a result of not seeking wild and scenic status, but rather, kind of gathering together the communities along this stretch of river to see how it could be better protected and managed locally, at least. You know, we kept an eye on what was happening with wild and scenic across the country, and quite frankly, in the intervening decades, the program became much more robust, locally driven, user-friendly and began to morph into this partnership Wild and Scenic River program, which is really dependent on and driven by the folks who live in the area in partnership with the National Park Service. And ultimately, the River Commission, representing the towns along this stretch, decided that they wanted to try again.
And now this is the first of its kind designation in Connecticut and one of the first or the first in New England?
Well, no, it is. We do have a couple of, you know, the Farmington River, for example.
Oh, okay.
Has a Wild and Scenic River stretch on it that probably has been in place for several decades. And most recently, a new stretch of Farmington going a little farther south was also added. There is the Salmon River, which is also a Wild and Scenic stretch, 8 mile. You know, we may be the fourth in Connecticut. It's certainly, you know, played out in a way that convinced people along the river that, you know, we had dealt with some big kind of out of scale development proposals. Super 7 was one of them that really threatened to cut through the most scenic stretch of river through northwest Connecticut, and a few other things. Low-level radioactive waste sites were being proposed at one time up and down the river valley. You know, I think in many ways what the Wild and Scenic River Act does is at least give projects that require federal permits a checkpoint where the federal, you know, the federal agencies that are looking at these land use applications have to consider the fact that if it is a wild and scenic river, why did it qualify? What are the values, the scenic values and the recreational values that make this river so outstanding? And they have to make sure that the proposed activity isn't going to destroy those values. It's you know, it's not a an automatic no, but it but it provides a way for, you know, weighing in on what the people of the region feel is important enough to protect.
Yeah, you also point out something really important, and that is you and I have already talked about in previous visits how the COVID era has sort of reinvigorated recreational use, maybe not quality, but certainly by quantity of users on your stretch of the river. And now this designation is certainly going to come with its heightened level of promotion so that folks very far away from the tri-state area or lower New England are going to start hearing about this, and the kind of the wild and scenic groupies or the wild and scenic heads that travel around to paddle or visit all of these designated sites may be eventually, you know, converging on the area. So this designation does not just kind of lump this added responsibility onto your group and the Housatonic River Commission without some funds to underwrite, you know, maintenance and administration, right?
Yeah. And, it, you know, it's really interesting that you circled back to that. I think the last time we talked, I was explaining how many more people had already found the Housatonic River. And it really, I think, was a function of COVID and people searching for places to be safe and comfortable and outdoors. The Housatonic River, and especially this particular stretch, already has what I would call global notoriety among certain kinds of river recreationalists, right? It is a very well-known fly fishing
for the trout,
stretch of river, for example, right? And it's written up in books in all kinds of languages all across the globe. So it already appealed to people from far away who want to come and fish it. It also has class 4 rapids. around the Bulls Bridge area. So right. it already attracted people that wanted to test their mettle, you know, against its white waters, mm-hmm. you know. And it had a number, it's got about a handful of readily accessible places where you can pull off from the road and just, you know, fish or swim or put your boat in the water. And during COVID, what we saw was in that first year, that summer of 2020, we saw usage triple, quadruple. And still we only have, you know, the same number of access sites. So
sure.
instead of a handful of people, suddenly there were 100 or 200
oh,
people.
Oh, Lynn, I have to tell you, during my my summer Sunday drives up county from the Waterbury, Danbury area where I live, I was running into parking lot situations, double, triple parked vehicles along fairly narrow two-lane roads. Certainly witnessed at least a couple of homeowners sternly talking with visitors and noticing license plates from as far away as places like, you know, Maryland and Pennsylvania, multiple, you know, clustered in these impromptu parking areas along residential yeah. roads by the river. So I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. Very dangerous situation for the folks, you know, parking in those places and folks like you trying to just drive by.
Yeah.
Yeah, it became really overwhelming. Mm. So much so that towns were shutting down their river access sites. And look, my organization loves people who love the river.
Yeah.
And, the fact is that we've got to work together with the River Commission and with the elected leadership of these communities and with the people who love the river to find ways to accommodate the different kinds of uses. Because you can imagine how hard it is to catch a fish when you've got 50 people paddling in the water, you know, 20 yards away.
Sure.
You know, so and clearly there are ways to spread people out and to accommodate the folks who just want to come and have a family picnic and those who are, you know, really seeking the solitude of an afternoon of fly fishing.
Right.
This
so
river can accommodate those things. Yeah.
So the underwriting for the management plan that needs to be developed or amended will be helpful.
Absolutely. In fact, I would guess that the sense of being overwhelmed that our elected officials were feeling during the last few years and really having no other choice but to close down recreational sites. I would guess that fed into a strong desire to get the Wild and Scenic River designation, because it's not a huge amount of money, but it's a, you know, $100,000. It's enough to help these seven towns come together and work together with you know, the National Park Service, groups like mine, the Teutonic
sure.
Valley Association, and others, to create a plan that will help people access the river for the kinds of things they want to do in a safe way. And that funding, again, it's not huge, but it's critically important. And that's really what we're looking forward to doing over the next few years.
Yeah.
The Housatonic River Commission, our partner in this whole effort, does have a management plan, as you just alluded to. It needs to be updated, and it needs to address the challenges that we face today. As opposed to the challenges that we were looking at back in 2007.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of which, I was going to say in the last 2 minutes or so that we have with you, Lynn, we do want to remind people, of course, many access points to the Housatonic River, particularly this section, the 41 miles that's recently been designated federally as the Wild and Scenic River. You know, folks come 12 months a year. And at this point, especially with the lack of winter that we've been experiencing, a lot of people may be heading out in the coming weeks ahead of spring and daylight savings time. And around this time, we want to make sure that they're safe. So I guess probably best to leave the conversation with a requisite reminder to anybody who's coming out and actually getting onto or into the river to be as safe as possible.
Absolutely. Please, please wear your personal flotation device. The water is icy, icy cold. And even an experienced swimmer used to cold water can be overtaken pretty quickly by the temperature. Wear your personal flotation device, even if you're an expert swimmer, even if you're in a boat and you think the boat will keep you safe. The water's very high. Even without a lot of snow, we've had a lot of precip, a lot of rain. And unfortunately, we have experienced drownings on this river with too much regularity.
Yeah.
And it's usually somebody who's feeling pretty safe and confident and not putting on their personal flotation device. So thank you, John. That is a really critically important thing to remember.
Great. We want to remind folks, if they want to learn more about the Wild and Scenic designation, about all the great things the Housatonic Valley Association and its partners, the Housatonic River Commission, are doing, they can not only visit, but hopefully support the organization with a donation to help keep the plans and coordination among the communities that will welcome you to the side of the Housatonic River in sync. You can go to hvatoday.org and learn all about the good work of the Housatonic Valley Association. And we are planning to welcome Bill from the Housatonic River Commission to sort of pick up on this conversation at some point in the coming weeks. So he will get his necessary dose of For the People Love as well. In the meantime, Lynn, we do really appreciate your coming on the program today to help us begin the Wild and Scenic designation celebration here on our radio stations. Thank you so much. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.